Hello everyone and welcome to this online session, CBI Safeguarding Expectations Following Letter to Payment and E-Money Firms. My name is Niamh McConaughey and I'm the Marketing Executive at FSCom, and I'm delighted to introduce the Director of FSCom, Alison Donnelly, and Senior Manager, Greg James. Before I pass you over to Alison, I need to just make you aware of some housekeeping. The audience is on mute and you will only be able to hear Alison, Greg and myself throughout the session. If you have any questions, please post them into the question box on the side panel and we will try and get through as many as we can in the Q&A session at the end. Any questions not answered will be followed up by an email next week. Finally, we always get asked if this session is recorded, and yes, it is. You will receive this recording in a follow-up email and it will be available on the FSCom website in the next few days. That's all from me, so over to you, Alison.
Thank you, Niamh, and thank you everybody who's joined our webinar. We've had over 100 people sign up and a few questions, really great questions posed to us in advance. So we're looking forward to this discussion, and please, as Niamh said, feel free to add questions as we progress through the first part of the session. I am Alison Donnelly, a Payments Regulation Specialist and Director of FSCom. FSCom is a compliance, governance and risk consultancy. We specialise in payment services and e-money and have done so since we established 12 years ago. I joined 10 years ago from the FCA, where I was the e-money policy specialist. And so over the course of these 10, 12, 13 years, I've been working with payment and e-money institutions on safeguarding and other things. But FSCom in particular has put a lot of material into the public domain about the safeguarding obligations. And indeed, we have done webinars and publications in the past. Some of those links will be provided to you in the chat by Niamh. That's me. Let me ask Greg to introduce himself.
Thanks, Alison. So hi, everyone. I'm Greg James, as Alison said, and I'm a senior manager in FSCom. I've been in financial services for around 10 years now, and six of those have been within GRC consulting or governance, risk and compliance consulting. That really ranged from roles within a standard credit institution and has been a variety of different experiences and roles that I've engaged with as part of GRC consulting. Most relevantly for ourselves today, that's been really assisting with FSCom safeguarding advisory and the assurance pieces within both the UK and Ireland. And I think hopefully I can bring some of that experience to help answer questions and to help direct this webinar. Also for myself, I am a fellow of the Compliance Institute here in Ireland, and utilize sort of that avenue to hopefully engage, and hopefully it will not be the first time some of you have seen me. But yes, that's myself anyway.
Thanks, Greg. We've decided to do a number of questions between us. So what we thought we'll start with is giving you a basics of safeguarding. I imagine that most of you have already been or familiar with safeguarding, but probably just to get us all on the same page, Greg, can I ask you to outline the basics of safeguarding?
Yes, absolutely. So I think for our purposes here, it's well worth sort of breaking this into three different points. And that is, very first off, why does safeguarding exist? What is safeguarding? And principally speaking, the objective of safeguarding is to protect user funds and to ensure that upon a potential insolvency event, that those funds can be repatriated to the underlying user. In other words, the funds can go back to the payment service user or to the e-money holder. Now that is technically minus costs of distribution, but that is principally the objective. It is a very, very core part of how the customer is protected when utilizing the regulated services provided by e-money and payment institutions. So where's this actually coming from? What is the regulation? What's the landscape? What are we actually looking at here? And realistically, what we're looking at here is both hard and soft law. From a hard law perspective, we have the legislation itself. The legislation is set out within the Payment Services Regulations 2018 in Ireland and is passed by the EuroCTAS. And it's worth mentioning that effectively, it's very, very similar to how it was originally transcribed in PSD2 and the second electronic money directive. It is almost effectively a copy and paste. And that is effectively where we get the hard rules for safeguarding. That isn't always the easiest way to understand a piece of legislation. So the central bank has also provided guidance, and the central bank hasn't been as free with its guidance as other regulators have, like the FCA, but they certainly have given us a lot of stuff to think about. Once upon a time, if you remember, there was originally prudential guidance for e-money institutions that did discuss and did opine on certain elements of safeguarding. Now, that was back in 2011 and has been withdrawn because it wasn't updated on the back of the introduction of PSD2. But there were some interesting learnings from that document, and that is something we will sort of explore throughout our discussions. More recently, we've had a good bit more from the central bank. That's come in the form of two Dear CEO letters, one in December 2021, where the central bank outlined what their supervisory expectations were. And they did speak about attestations to your safeguarding processes, along with a variety of other elements. But for our purposes here, spoke about safeguarding. And then in January 2023, they released their new Dear CEO letter that discussed safeguarding and certainly how they viewed the current status of safeguarding arrangements within the regulated sector. And that there's some real key elements in that I'm sure we will touch on at some point in this discussion. And then finally, we have the May communication, which is effectively a clarification on the audit requirements or the attestation requirements set out within the January 2023 Dear CEO letter. That is high level what we're talking about when we talk about safeguarding. And within that context, you will hear us refer to two separate types of safeguarding methodologies, one of which is segregation, whereby you segregate the client funds or the user funds in a safeguarded account, or you utilize them to purchase a low risk secure liquid asset that is protected under the terms of client funds. And then you have the bond guarantee, effectively that a credit institution or an insurance broker or another comparable entity will insure the funds that sit underneath. And those are the two mechanisms that you will hear us refer to throughout this webinar. So that's sort of a very brief overview. And on the surface, it all seems fairly straightforward, but actually the devil's in the details. And when you introduce this to real processes, complexities can come into it. So I think I'll go back to Alison and ask, where does this become problematic? Where are the difficulties that lie in what could potentially be seen as quite simple process?
That's right. I always think it's like this. It's relatively straightforward to see one sum of money come in for a payment transaction and it flows through the system. If we're using segregation method into the segregated account, then in turn into the safeguarding account and then off to the beneficiary. But most payments firms have a lot more complexity in their business model, multiple sums, amounts received throughout the day, multiple funds sent out during the day, FX, multiple different safeguarding accounts, maybe even multiple different safeguarding providers, and therefore accounts money is in different places. So there is a lot of complexity in the process. As you say, the legislation itself is very basic and straightforward, but where the devil's in the detail. And what we haven't had, as you've mentioned, is we've had some guidance and opinions from the central bank, and certainly we've seen a lot more scrutiny of safeguarding arrangements at the gateway, and of course now that with the Dear CEO letters, but we haven't had much more formal than that. So turning to where we have found complexities, look, we've been doing safeguarding audits since FSCom started. And over the past couple of years, say we've done about 100, maybe just over 100 safeguarding audits, primarily on firms in the UK, but there have also been some firms in Ireland who have taken up the opportunity to have their arrangements tested. What we find, I'll give you a number of the things that we find where firms make mistakes. First of all, commingling. So we have seen firms use buffers, hold too much funds in the safeguarding account, very legitimate reasons. They'd rather overfund than underfund. They'd rather have the buffer there in case there's a liquidity issue. They want to make sure that funds are protected and that there's enough funds for customers. But as we'll describe in more detail as we go through this, potentially that is problematical in itself. We've seen examples where reconciliations really are not done regularly during the working week, and indeed perhaps even that the reconciliations, that the data is not analysed close enough to the point at which the data is pulled. So there's scope for discrepancies there. We've seen areas where governance of outsourcing isn't where we would expect it to be. So for example, reconciliations and segregations are done, but they're done by an outsourced team. That in itself is not problematical, but as everybody knows, the central bank expects the entity that they have authorized to take control over that oversight, and sometimes that just isn't done. And quite often, again, for the very simple reason that firms see themselves as being one firm, but in this practice, it cannot be the case. And sort of allied to that, we've also seen instances where firms outside of the regulated entity have access over the accounts and are able to move money in and out of the accounts, the safeguarding accounts, in a way that is not well controlled by the regulated entity. And I think the issue, the overlying issue here, is that the rules on safeguarding are in statutory regulations, but they do not determine and dictate how this will happen, how an insolvency procedure will happen in practice. And the crunch of this is, if a firm goes bust, what really happens? Because how does this statutory regulations intersect with insolvency legislation? In other jurisdictions, and quite possibly in Ireland as well, the need is for absolute precision. It should only be the exact amount in the safeguarding account at any time, under safeguarding or over safeguarding, are as bad as each other. But that precision is often in practice quite difficult to get to. So that's what we find when we audit. But let's turn to what the central bank has said are problems. Why has the central bank imposed this obligation to safeguard? Obligation to audit the safeguarding arrangements on firms. Greg.
Yeah, thanks, Alison. So really, there's a few things driving this, but I mean, as I stated previously, the objective of safeguarding is consumer protection, or customer protection probably more broadly. And the reality is that will always be a key objective of a regulator. They will always impose and oversee this with as much effort as they can under the central bank's prism model, of course. But that is realistically as pure customer protection as it gets, is safeguarding funds, keeping relevant user funds separate from your own funds. But there's a few other things at work here. So one of which is, there's a few macro drivers. The current economic uncertainty increases the likelihood of payment institutions and e-money firms failing. And where that economic uncertainty and that risk crystallize, there are potentials here for customer harm. Where there's potential for customer harm, keyly one of those areas could be where the firm is not safeguarding appropriately. Because if the firm isn't safeguarding appropriately, that pulls into question the funds and the customer funds into this slightly messy world of bankruptcy and how that really works in court, when determined into a court. So that's realistically a big driver here. And we've seen other elements drive that. Wind up strategies, wind down plans, being obligated as well is another element that was driven from this economic uncertainty. That was more to do with COVID rather than where we are now, but we are where we are now. The other issue is other regulators have found clarity issues with the regulation. And we've seen this within the consultation responses on the views of PSD2 that was published last year. And keyly here, there's a couple of questions being risen by regulators that are genuine questions and genuine areas of confusion. To Alison's point earlier, where are the confusions and where are the issues and the operational flows where this can be confusing? And some of the areas brought up by those regulators were things like banking cutoff times. They were how the card scheme rules feed into this process, and a variety of other elements that are effectively voicing a confusion on how these strict rules actually apply to a real model. On probably a more local level, I think what we're sort of going to use to drive the webinar itself is the Dear CEO letters from the Central Bank of Ireland. And I touched on these previously, but just to sort of focus down in on these, in 2021, Central Bank released their Dear CEO letter that touched on a few different things, but principally what it requested in that letter was an attestation to the health of the firm's safeguarding arrangements. And it asked for a variety of different things, whether the funds were identified appropriately, managed, protected on a day-to-day basis, whether it was appropriately run through governance processes on a first, second, and third line basis. Now, that attestation generated a response, obviously, for the central bank. And what they found within that was 1 in 4 PIs and EMIs has self-identified deficiencies. And in a population of 44 PIs and EMIs, that's 11, obviously, that have identified this. And that is something that has driven the central bank to ask further questions on this process and to get further assurance on how it's actually being run in the market. The good news is they were self-identified, right? So one of the key principles to take away from that is the assurance process worked. Firms received the attestation request, they went off and they did an assurance process internally to determine whether there were issues. And that assurance process determined that yes, there were, but it shows the effectiveness of that assurance process and also that obviously an action plan likely was generated from that. One of the key things, and I think it's sort of a burning question on everybody's mind at the moment, was within Appendix 1 of that letter was the areas that the central bank were requesting to be audited. And this is the some of the areas of deficiencies they found and therefore subsequently drove the element by which they wanted an independent auditor to determine. So that is really where we're following and is worth us jumping off from. And to that point then, this is where the central bank identifies risk. And one of those risks identified then as part of those attestations was the delays in segregated user funds following receipt. And Alison, could you sort of talk us through what that means and also how we might see that within a firm?
Certainly, this is a common misunderstanding I find myself explaining quite often. It sounds like there's an urban myth out there that safeguarding only has to start after 24 hours. In fact, safeguarding starts on receipt. The legislation is clear that funds have to be segregated, and then it's only that at the end of the business day following the day of receipt that they have to go into the special safeguarding account. Now, the legislation doesn't use special safeguarding account. I do that to try and distinguish how the funds need to be segregated first off. And in practice, that often means that firms, because firms are receiving funds electronically, that often means firms will put the funds directly into an account, just a special or nothing special about it, just a bog standard account, and then move them the following day into the special safeguarding account, which is the one that is recognized as being where there's no right of set off against it from the bank, and where no other firm has access or is able to touch the funds or write over those funds. This sort of two-step process is actually quite important for those who receive funds through their agents, or and indeed those who receive funds in cash, because it's not possible to directly put those funds into the special safeguarding account. So if an agent or a branch receives cash, or the agent receives the funds electronically, there's a period of time in which they can be moved from one account to the other. Now, going back to the point about segregation, the legislation says for the segregation method that the funds shall not be mixed at any time. It doesn't even say funds should be segregated immediately on receipt, because if we said immediately on receipt, there'd be a little bit of scope for interpretation of what does immediately mean. Does it mean literally right at the point of receipt? Or maybe it means in about an hour or two's time when we're able to get our operations aligned to be able to segregate. There just doesn't seem like any scope there. So maybe as one of the outcomes of this process that the central bank's going through at the moment, maybe they will opine on that and give some more scope. But when we're looking at this, we're wanting to see how the funds are segregated at the point of receipt. And it also lists this factor links to the second on the list of the appendix, and that is co-mingling of users' funds and non-user funds in safeguarding accounts. And like, we've seen examples of firms keeping, as I mentioned earlier, a buffer in the accounts for liquidity. Can absolutely understand why a firm would want to do that. Feels like a very wise, operationally sensible thing to do, to make sure that you always have the funds at the customer's disposal. But nonetheless, because of this intersection between the regulations and the insolvency legislation, where it may be possible for a administrator or creditor to argue that the funds in the safeguarding account are not just for the purposes of protecting user funds, that they are therefore within scope in an insolvency situation, and that the funds that are being kept for users could be dispersed to other creditors. And of course, that's what we don't want to happen. So Greg, I've managed to cover two of those there, so I'll let you talk about the third, which is failing to reconcile that the correct amounts are being segregated on a daily basis.
Yes. So yeah, thanks, Alison. I think there's a few things to pull out here, one of which is two key terms used there, one of which is reconcile and the other which is segregate or segregated. It is well worth us clarifying here that they are two separate processes. Now, a lot of firms and a lot of institutions will conflate the terms. They are technically different processes. We often find people will run a segregation process as part of its reconciliation. And what one of the things we will want to make clear here is that where we are, the reconciliation is to check that the segregation is done appropriately, and that the cash flows are processed. So that is what the reconciliation is doing. The segregation is the physical movement of those funds. So taking the funds either from the safeguarding account where they're no longer user funds, or putting the funds into the safeguarding account where they are safeguarded funds. The user funds. That is the process of segregation. Now, there's many different ways and many different flows, you know, that is happening when the funds are first received into a segregated account. When they are moved, you're segregating them again into a safeguarding account. But that, you know, strictly speaking, from a high level perspective, that's what we're referring to. When we get to the reconciliation, though, because that's effectively what's being asked here, is the failure to reconcile. what we want to sort of make clear here is that there's two different reconciliations we should be running on a daily basis, at least. And some of you may remember this from the Prudential document. It has not been as explicit recently, but it is regardless good practice to run two separate types of reconciliation, one of which is referred to as an internal reconciliation, and the other of which is called an external reconciliation. An internal reconciliation is the process by which you are ensuring the records held by you as the firm are correct. It's effectively a secondary control. This is undertaken in a lot of different ways. There are standard and non-standard ways of running it, but you know, to avoid us going through every single business model and running through how that might look, realistically, that can be done in a lot of different ways. And the key part here is you're doing that through internal sources of information. You're not doing it through external sources of information. What a lot of you will also do is the external reconciliation. And that is where you take that internal record of the amount you're supposed to be safeguarding and you compare that to your external record, typically represented by your credit institution bank account. Through the segregation method. Now, there's a few different ways that might run in a few different models, but strictly speaking, you're comparing your internal record to an external source at that stage then. And that's the differentiator. So moving on from there then, the central bank also talk about another deficiency that they find, and that was quite relevantly to the external rec was the bank accounts that where user funds were being held were incorrectly designated, and therefore user funds could potentially be inappropriately exposed. So on that point then, Alison, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so clearly it makes a nonsense of safeguarding protections if the bank account itself in which the funds are being held isn't clearly labelled as such. The point when it really matters is when an insolvency practitioner has to come in and pick up and understand where the funds are being held and where they're being kept. So we need to see that the account is properly named to show that it's a special safeguarding account. I think it's also worth noting that firms need to be careful that it really is truly a special safeguarding account and that they have required the bank to make sure that they are not able to access the funds to pay off debt, so no right of set off. There should also be arrangements so that if there's any bank charges, the bank charges are not taken from this account and that indeed interest isn't paid into that account, because that's just going to end up resulting in co-mingling or underfunding. So the account needs to be properly clearly set out as the safeguarding account. So broader than that, obviously, there's a point about documentation, but I think you might be coming to that shortly. In terms of the account, we have a template produced by the FCA of a standard acknowledgement letter where it goes through the various details that the bank in offering this account to you as the payment or e-money institution takes into account and accepts. That's a very useful starting point. Perhaps the central bank will produce their own version of that, but if they don't, then it would be worth looking at the FCA's version and basing your own acknowledgement letters on that. Greg, the next one is failure to maintain adequate insurance policies or comparable guarantees on an ongoing basis where relevant.
There, the classic mistake. Yes, so this lends itself more to the insurance or the bond guarantee. Really what we're talking about here is this policy appropriate for the protection of the underlying funds? And it's sort of the second methods version of this segregated method that Alison was talking about and the appropriate designation of the accounts. There's a few things to consider whenever you are looking and you're assessing the appropriateness of one of these insurance policies or comparable guarantees when you are managing them, one of which is renewal times. So do not leave yourself in doubt of securing the protection. In other words, at least 3 months before you are going to renew, you should be re-engaging with that provider, potentially looking at other providers where you want to separate the concentration risk. Maybe you weren't overly happy with the service for any reason. You should be starting that process long before the deadline of the insurance. And that is absolutely key, or else there is potential. There is a point in which actually user funds are not protected. And obviously that the central bank won't have any appetite for that. One of the key risks when it comes to the insurance product is whether you have enough value on that insurance or that bond to cover your user asset liability. And that's a lot simpler to manage when it's segregated, because the user funds are going into the segregated or the safeguarded account, so you will always have them. But where that isn't necessarily the case for the insurance product, what that means is there are stages where your average pay value and volumes could be 10 million, let's say, and actually you get a sudden spike, movement in the markets, whatever it is, and that might spike to your user liability to 12 or 13 million. That is going to result in a shortfall of 2 or 3 million euros, which would not be acceptable to the central bank. So you need to build in a buffer into that process. And you do see triggers within firms. So where they do implement the insurance process, they will have a trigger. So if it goes to a certain limit, then an alert will trigger. And that will mean that further there's potential there for increasing the overall value of that bond or that insurance policy. So that is an absolutely key metric and an absolutely key risk indicator for you to continue to monitor. Because if you're constantly breaching or you're constantly coming near your value statement, then you will need to change your policy in response. One of the other elements is you need to make sure that the details of the insurance policy or the guaranteed bond are guaranteed to pay out. So they must be guaranteed to pay out, even in the case of administration errors or fraud. It needs to be airtight. Consumer funds must be protected throughout that. What the central bank will not want is a court case being opened up on these funds with the insurance or their bond not wanting to pay out. So that must be ironclad. It must be very, very clear. And finally, it must be paid out to a safeguarded account. So the recipient of those funds must land in a safeguarded account. So even if you do have the insurance policy, you should have a safeguarded account with a credit institution. That is where the proceeds of that policy will pay out to. And within that safeguarded account, that is where it receives its protection. And that is what will provide them with the comfort. So the next question then is one we actually see quite a lot, and is one that the central bank has always flagged at the authorization stage, and that is control over the safeguarding accounts. And Alison, you did touch on this previously, but I think it's well worth us discussing it, because it is specifically called out here in the Dear CEO letter, and that is the control over the safeguarding account rest outside of the firm, for example, with a group entity. And the central bank have identified that as a potential deficiency. Could you touch back on that and discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, this is certainly being flagged a lot, as we can see at the authorization stage, where certainly whenever an applicant puts their application in, the number of staff can be quite minimal to begin with, and so they rely on their outsourced service providers to move funds and do reconciliation and all sorts of operational activities, and it needs to be very carefully articulated to the central bank that the control of the accounts rests within the applicant firm or indeed the regulated firm on authorisation. And I do have some sympathy for group entities, because in every other respect they see themselves acting as one firm, and firms that come new to authorisation regulation find this very difficult to grasp the distinction. But look, it's a point that has, the battle has already been lost on this. The regulator will not change their mind. It seems very unlikely. So let's focus on the fact that you need to be able to articulate the distinction and evidence that the control rests within the entity that is regulated by the central bank. So we'll move on to the next one, which is connected in a way, and that is that there is insufficient oversight of arrangements for managing the safeguarding of users' funds. For example, a lack of policy documentation at the legal entity level, i.e. referable to the central bank authorised payment and e-money firm, and a lack of effective and regular monitoring and review of safeguarding. Greg.
Yeah, so principally this is a question of governance, risk and control. That is effectively what we're getting at here. The central bank have specifically called out policy documentation within that, and there's a few takeaways here, one of which is it needs to be at the legal entity level because it should be signed off at board or third board committee. That is the level of risk underlied here. So safeguarding is quite a high risk area, as we've been discussing, and as such, it should be signed off at a board level or a board committee level. It needs that level of seniority within the firm to sign it off. And it should be, and in fact, it's the central bank's expectation that that is on a local level. So it has to be the local board, should not be group policy. That is one of those areas that the central bank will not accept. We should also consider how this all looks in reality from a governance perspective. And what we should be doing is applying good risk management control here. So that is mapping the rules, understanding the risks that underlie those rules. So how does that present a risk to the firm or to the underlying customer? We are determining what our controls are to mitigate that risk, and whether that pulls that risk within an residual risk appetite of the firm. And then we need to monitor whether that continues to be the case. So whenever you are first authorized, you will run that through effectively assumptions and expert opinions. But actually, when you generate actionable data through your monitoring on an ongoing basis, you should start to see whether controls are working effectively, whether there are any gaps in those controls, and actually the inherent or the residual risk is not what you previously identified it as. These are all elements that we should be considering throughout the operational aspect of the of safeguarding, but also on a counterparty level. So we should be, and we, in fact, we are obligated to risk assess the underlying counterparty. So the counterparty that is assisting you in safeguarding, and that is typically the insurance provider or the underwriter, the insurance underwriter technically, or the credit institution or authorized custodian providing the accounts. We need to be really clear here as well, especially when dealing with the three lines of defense model, that there are clear distinctions between those three lines of defense, what those activities are on a frontline, second line and third line basis, and how they apply to the safeguarding process, because those are really, really key areas of control and process that the Central Bank of Ireland absolutely want to be able to see and be able to map. And we want to be able to show that we are not blurring the lines inappropriately, because that is something that we should not be doing as part of that best practice governance process. We should also then consider then within that, if any of this goes wrong, we need a process to report to the regulator. That is something that obviously everybody's quite uncomfortable with when it comes, but we need to have really, really clear processes by which, what do we identify as an issue? What do we identify as a breach? What is reportable to the regulator here? Because they're not necessarily clear rules to that, right? So it is important that we consider that you consider that throughout this process. To that point, then I'm going to move on to the next one, which is the next deficiency was that consumer fees, other charges were inappropriately taken out of the safeguarding account, leading to potential shortfalls of user funds. Alison, do you want to touch on that?
Well, hopefully it doesn't come as a surprise to anybody listening to this, or indeed anybody with familiarity with safeguarding, that there's no scope for leaving the safeguarding account underfunded. So this might be referring to something that I mentioned earlier, which is perhaps the bank taking its charges against the payment or e-money institution out of the funds. Perhaps that's what it's meaning by consumer fees, certainly other charges. And of course, we also need to be mindful, as I mentioned earlier, that if the bank is paying interest on those safeguarded funds, that the interest is not applied to the safeguarding account, and that allows the account to stay as pure as possible. We were sort of talking about this earlier, Greg, and we sort of thought one possible interpretation of the wording is that consumer fees, we wondered, were there examples where somehow the consumer fees had got into the safeguarding account and hadn't been taken out, or if the consumer fee, the consumers had been charged incorrectly or inappropriately by the payment or e-money firm. We don't know that for sure, and if any listener is the firm to which this applies, do let us know. But we'll keep it absolutely anonymous, of course. But that sounds like a failure in another control rather than technically or strictly speaking a safeguarding control. But examples of where we see shortfalls when payments firms move the money out of the safeguarding account to pay for FX and or use another payment or e-money institution as the route to pay the payee. And let me just explain that a little bit further. So on the example of where a payment or e-money institution is using another payment or e-money institution in moving the funds, this is an infinitely sensible approach, because that payment or e-money institution might well be able to move the funds much more efficiently and cost effectively than the safeguarding partner, the banking partner. Or indeed, in some corridors, you have to go through another partner to get the funds to the end destination. However, that raises a difficulty for you in that you will have to move the funds from the safeguarding account in order to send it to another payment or e-money institution or another banking partner. Now, in the situation where that banking partner is not a safeguarding provider, and of course, in the situation where it's a payment or e-money institution that's used, that's problematical because the funds are now no longer in the safeguarding protection. In the case of a payment or e-money institution, some firms might say, but the payment or e-money institution is safeguarding the funds at that point. And I hear what you're saying, but I don't think it's sufficient. And the reason being is, of course, that they are safeguarding for you as you are their customer. They are not safeguarding for your customers, and therefore your obligation to safeguard is not fulfilled. In the case where FX happens, we have seen firms both remove the funds from the safeguarding account in order to purchase the currency from the liquidity provider. And we've also seen examples where the funds do not leave the safeguarding protection for the purchase of currency. And we think that both of these models can stand true as long as they're consistently applied. And let me explain the difference. So in some businesses, they are very definitely set up as an FX provider. We get you the best rates on your currency deals. You will then need us to make that payment to so-and-so to pay that invoice. We'll do that. That's a secondary ancillary other thing that we do. But primarily, we're an FX broker. And in that situation, I would expect that it's very clear to the customer. You enter into a contract for FX. In the case of spot FX or deliverable forwards, it's a non-regulated contract. Therefore, there is no protection provided for the funds. We'll convert the currency. Once the currency has been converted, then we will safeguard and we will pay it out, because that's the payment service portion of the contract. That works for me. In the situation where they say, we are brilliant at moving money, we can move it around all different directions, that's what we do, give us your money, we will make sure that so-and-so has the right amount from you. That to me is a purely a payment service play, and therefore I think it would be absolutely right for the customer to expect that while the funds are in your possession and until they're received by the beneficiary, they are safeguarded. And I would expect the safeguarding protection to last the entire period. And therefore, in that situation, you may well have to use your own funds to purchase currency, or use the insurance method or guarantee in order to cover that, whether it's to allow the liquidity there. And those are the examples that I can see where funds might be mixed or the safeguarding protection's broken. We're now at the last one on the list, Greg, and that is failure to evidence adequate consideration of the impact of operational changes, including material changes in the business strategy, on safeguarding arrangements.
Thanks, Alison. I mean, to very quickly pick up on something we're sort of running through there, and that is the interaction between unregulated FX, the protection of funds throughout that. And it is worth mentioning here, especially with the central bank's current consultation on the new consumer duty code, sorry, like consumer protection code. It's an absolutely key area that the payment service user understands very, very clearly that those funds are not protected during that FX leg, if that is the way you've structured the payment, that the funds become non-relevant for the FX trade. That is absolutely key that they understand. And that doesn't mean you put it as a clause within terms and conditions, because if we're all honest with ourselves, people typically don't read terms and conditions. It needs to be a good bit clearer for that. And you should consider that what that communication strategy looks like, depending on what your target market is. If you are dealing with professional firms, that communication looks very different to you dealing with day-to-day consumers. And their understanding of that will be very, very different. So I just thought it's a really interesting point. I thought it'd be worth sort of highlighting on that aspect as well. On the impacts and the failure to evidence adequate considerations, what we're really talking about here is change management and understanding when a change happens within the firm, whether that's through an event, whether it's through an incident, whatever it is. Maybe it's a business model change that has cascading effects across your business. One of those areas that it might have cascading effects on is safeguarding. And we need processes and governance aspects and arrangements here in order to control for that. So to pick out some of the things that the Central Bank have actually referenced here, so changes to the business strategy. So top-down governance is absolutely required here. And we need a clear business strategy that's consistent with the strategic objectives, vision, and regulatory requirements of the institution. And where that changes, we should be conscious of whether that changes anything else. Probably most obviously, where the business strategy is to go down a different payment services activity, that can have material effects on the safeguarding process. And that is absolutely worth mapping out and understanding how that will affect the business. Where there are changes to something as intrinsic as that, or to the operational processes that drive safeguarding, then they need to be identified, they need to be assessed, and potentially that is put through an impact assessment to understand how that actually affects the firm and in its current processes. It's absolutely key that you understand that, and you can apply that then to the safeguarding process as well. So, slightly conscious of time, but I've seen two questions from attendees here that are well worth a quick discussion. One of which is, what does the CBI expect to get out of the requirement to audit? And somebody else has asked what our thoughts are on why the central bank didn't actually include the scope verification of the accuracy of the amount of safeguarded funds at the reference date. Alison, do you want to have a go at the what the central bank are expecting to get out of this?
Yes, I'll answer that one. Plus also, esteemed former colleague has asked a question about the annual safeguarding audit requirement. Will that be in the case in the UK? So look, there's nothing that shines a light on arrangements better than an audit and gets people's attention. So I think what the central bank is very definitely hoping to get is focus and also to begin helping firms understand, individuals who run firms understand the specifics of the safeguarding obligations. As I think we've elaborated on today, it is complex and there is a dearth of familiarity with those requirements. So I think what they're hoping to get out of it is focus and improvements. Possibly it might well become an annual requirement, but perhaps the question is, why wasn't it an annual expectation that firms would be doing this anyway? Certainly what we've seen with the UK firms who were now on the process of auditing for the second or third time, the number of findings dramatically diminishes. Greg?
Yeah, so on the aspect of the accuracy of the funds, the central bank are clearly focusing this on a process and control perspective. And implicitly, they are asking this question and on the accuracy, where they ask for processes and controls around when the when you identify the funds as the users, what the start of that process is and what the end of that fund flow is. We also have a requirement there to do the information technology controls and that should then by nature speak to the integrity of the data presented through that technology. And the way the majority of you will operate is this is all being done in some manner through a technological service, right? So that will speak to the integrity of that data. But yes, it's very process and control perspective rather than explicitly requesting the accuracy. And that's fairly common for the central bank. They will take things in a process and control driven manner, and they will answer for the accuracy of those funds implicitly through that.
Oh, thank you for that, everyone. We have only 8 minutes left, so we've got a lot of questions to get through, but we'll just get through as many as we can, and then you will get a follow-up email from Alison and Greg with any ones that were not answered. So one of the first questions is, are many firms in the market actually safeguarding through investing in secure low-risk assets? What sort of assets has the CBI signed off on in your experience?
Let's take that. Yeah, I'll go ahead and jump on that one. Secure low-risk assets has become far more popular over the past year or so. We probably have more evidence speaking to this on a UK front, but I think there's some key learnings we can take from that. And that is, one, as interest rates and as inflation, et cetera, has gone south, what's happened is people have been seeking out low-risk secure assets more commonly. And from when we first started doing safeguarding audits, that was very rare to see it, to being far, far more common. We're getting queries about how you might do that. Now, I'm not aware of the central bank signing off any assets explicitly at this time, but typically what you will find is government bonds are quite a common application, but the devil is in the details there, as I've said a few times here, on what that is, what government bond, the maturity date, etc. Typically what you're looking for here is something that has a very low capital risk rating under the CRD. That is really what we're looking for here, preferably 0%, at most maybe 1.6%, which is what the EBA are currently pitching for in PSD3. So that's sort of that there. Yeah.
Perfect, thank you, Greg. Okay, the next question is, You mentioned segregated accounts and then onto a safeguarding account. I understand why this may be needed for cash. However, is it possible in general to have one safeguarded account, also segregated, not sure why this is needed for both. In settlement is directed always in the safeguarded account. Do I need to repeat that question?
No, that's fine. I think you're making the very fair point is, can we pay funds directly into the safeguarded account? And I don't see any reason why not, as long as you're able to segregate and that the customers, the fees or profit that's owed to you is out of the safeguarding account. The central bank hasn't opined on that. I am taking this as a point of reference from the FCA. The FCA say that they have taken the position that if for the customer's convenience, you want to be able to get the customer to pay all fees along with their funds to one account, which makes sense, because if you start asking customers, oh, pay this amount here and this amount there, it gets too complicated, right? So for the customer's convenience, the funds could all go into the segregated account, but in the UK legislation, they should never go into the safeguarding account. And so the UK has come up with a position that there could be an element of commingling in seg, never in safeguarding. And that might be why, for this person who's asked the question, you might want to have both a segregated account and a safeguarding account. But if your flow is such that it's all perfectly segregated, then yes, absolutely. I don't see why you shouldn't put the funds into the safeguarding account straight away.
I probably have room for one more. Let me just see. Okay. Who, in your view, does the CBI expect to be the person assigned by those charged of governance to have overall responsibility for compliance with safeguarding regulations from the description of organisation requirements doc 1B? Sorry, I'm really bad. Do you need that repeated?
No. I think what you're asking, and of course, correct me if you're wrong, and we'll pick it up later. But I think what you're asking is the distinction between the first and second line, with first line taking responsibility for safeguarding policies. So that's the best way to make sure that these lines are segregated. So policies and action decisions should be made at first line. And in our experience, either a head of operations or a head of finance, with a slight preference to the head of finance being the person responsible at the first line, and that leaves second line to be able to take a oversight responsibility, which is exactly what second line should be doing.
I think the absolutely key point is whoever is taking responsibility for it is first line, and that they're suitably and appropriately skilled to do that, and they are appropriately senior, so they have a clear reporting line to a senior governance body to ensure that they have enough weight within the firm to raise issues and to hopefully get them remediated where there are issues.
Which probably actually, Greg, speaks to the point that the board should equally be fully understanding of what the safeguarding obligations are and how they, because they take ultimate responsibility and delegate it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, the board awareness is absolutely key here. The board should understand, if not necessarily precisely every process step of the reconciliation process, they should understand how the firm safeguards, what that typically looks like on a day-to-day basis, and what is the purpose of safeguarding, and why is it so important to the culture of the firm that compliance is met in this area.
Brilliant. I'm very mindful of time. Thank you very much, guys, for your contribution here. Thank you very much, attendees, for what are actually brilliant questions. I'm so sorry we have only been able to get to just a few of them. As Niamh said, we will follow up, and there will be an email in your inbox very shortly with the link to our webinar, and probably a client survey. I'm sure we're asking for feedback. Please do give us feedback on what you liked about this webinar, what you didn't, and future webinar topics that would be of interest to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.